This is an interview with Captain Frank Fabrizio for the Youngstown State University Oral History Project, the specific project being Youngstown Fire Department by Mike Carrillo at number 12 Fire Station on September 24th at approximately 8 p.m. Captain Fabrizio, could you provide some information on your family background and schooling?
Well, I was born in Youngstown. And went to school out here. At the time it was called Scienceville, now it's called North High. It's on the east side of Youngstown here. And I graduated from high school. And at that time things were kind of rough because I got out of school in 31, and 29, 30, 31 was Depression days. And I had an opportunity to go to college. I had about six colleges that wanted me to go and play football for them. But the fellas I run around with, they're all working and had money, and I wasn't, and I decided to go to work. So then I got a job at the packing house through a friend of mine, and I worked there 10.5 years. And in the meantime, I had gotten married. And then World War II come along, and I went and was in the Navy. And just before I went to the Navy, I had a little girl. And so she was about 5 years old at the time. So when I come back out, I got a job down at Truscon and worked there for a while. About a year and a half till this job came up. I took an examination for the fire department. And come December 1st, I'll have my 32 years on, and hope to put one more lucky year on, and then I think I'll hang up the boots. So I have two girls at the time being. One is a nurse. She is married and lives in Girard and has two lovely girls, and my youngest girl is 7 years younger than her, and we had her after the service, come back from the service, and she had an education too, college. She was working in an office, and now she's married and has a youngster that's 1 year old. And that was about the extent of my family. I would like to have a boy, but things turned out that with the operation the wife had, well, we just couldn't have any more, and that was it. So.
Why did you become a fireman when you did? You said you took the examination.
Well, I talking to a friend of mine, and he was telling me why I should get on the fire department because of security reasons and pension reasons and things on that order. He says, without a college education, why, you're liable to be bumped out of a job and you're going to not be working and this, that, and the other. So I always had a job that never paid big money because a packing house job never paid big money. The only time I made bigger money was when the year and a half I was in Truscon before I come on here. Well, these jobs never made big money, but it was steady. So that you learn to live with, and if you want things, you just wait till you can arrange it to have it, and then you have it. So you learn to live with what you have, and we've gotten along real good, and I try to give the kids everything they had and needed that I never had, and we always got by. Nothing was real luxurious or anything like that, but it was always had plenty of food on the table, and that was the main thing, and we was able to keep our bills paid, and that's what really counted in the long run. So that's the way I looked at it. It was more or less for the future, for retirement, and it was a job that was a steady. You had a certain amount coming in all the time, and I thought, well, after thinking it over, something like that is better than some of these jobs where they make big money and they blow it, and then first thing you know, they're out of work, and then they don't have anything. So if you learn to live with less, well, you can get along with less. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the big reasons that I took the job.
What do you remember about your first years in the department?
Well, the first year I come on the department, I started in a house on Falls Avenue. It was a two-truck house. And that time, they didn't have a training program like we have today. And it seemed like in them days that they didn't tell you any more than they had to, like they was afraid you was going to take their job away from them. That's the truth. And And I always said, if I ever get in here and learn it, I try to make it as easy as possible for the next man, which I did. And that is why, after I had a few years on here, why I had such a tough time learning it myself and just following and watching without any instructions, that anytime we'd get a new man, why, I made it my business for him to learn as much as he could. And when I got to be a captain on this department, I wanted every man on my crew to know as much about that truck as I did. And not only the truck, but the work that we have to do, and always laid out the steps we were going to take, and everything just worked out lovely like that, because the more the crew knows about what you're doing, it just makes it easier for everybody, and you do a more efficient job, and you try to cut down your fire loss. And by everybody chipping in and doing the work that they're supposed to do, why, this can be accomplished. And that is why I always stick my neck out, any new fella, and just get a hold of him and just work with him till I think he knows just what the next step is going to be.
Mm-hmm. About how many different stations did you serve at, and did you hop around, and when did you receive your promotion, if you remember?
Well, I was a fireman for 11 years before I made an engineer's job. Mm-hmm. And I was engineer is the fellow that drives the truck. I was an engineer till about the last 14, 15 years when I become a captain. I've been a captain about 15 years. And that is when I took a big interest in helping others.
Mm-hmm. Has the basic equipment or the techniques of firefighting changed over the years that you've been in service?
Yes, it has. I'll tell you why. With the equipment we have today, years ago, even before my time, the pumpers that we had, they were steam driven, and you couldn't control your water, and there was an awful lot of water damage. And with the new equipment today, you can read any fire book and you'll find that 1/4 of your damage is fire and 3/4 is water damage. And that is why I like to work with high pressure, where you'll put out twice as much water with twice as much fire in half the amount of water. And I always preach to the fellows, if you see no flame, shoot no water, because the water is what does all your damage. And today we have equipment and trucks that you can control this, and but if you don't do it, it isn't the truck's fault. So you have to have men trained to how to equip their streams and things and control them. And with the equipment we got today, we can control just about any amount of water that we want to put on a fire.
Mm-hmm. We're sitting in here in Station 12, looks like the main office here. What's a physical description of a typical station as
typical station
here and the equipment within it?
All right. Now this room, like you're sitting in, you see this game well system. That's where we get our alarms. If there is a fire in town, that bell we have out on the apparatus floor will ring 5 times. Everybody gets ready, but nobody knows who's going to go until they give the address. And then they'll call the companies as to who's going to go and where they're going to go. It used to be all they gave us was a street number, and we had a book. And for example, out here at this station, if we heard a number starting with a 3, we knew we were going because that was our district. But what happened in them days, there was companies went that wasn't supposed to. There were some companies that were supposed to that never went. So now they have this game well system here. They'll ring the bell, let you know there's a fire, but you don't move till they call you. Even if it's next door, if they don't call you, you just don't move. So everything now is on the shoulders of the alarm operator, which is in our number one station downtown. And he tells us who goes and where. But up till then, why, we used to have this box 5, we call it, and anything we go out on ourselves, like a car fire or anything like that, they call us on the phone. That way they don't disturb the rest of the city. But now, a few months back, maybe a year, they started a new system that after 10 o'clock at night, they only dispatch the companies that are supposed to go to the fire, and that way they're not waking the whole city up 2, 3, 4 in the morning. And they have found through the country that most of the heart attacks come when that big bell goes off at night when you're sleeping. So now they have a little squawker system that they'll get you up. Only the companies that are going will be awakened, where before everybody in town used to be woke up, you see. So this much, it is much, much better right now. And out of this office here, you step into the apparatus floor where our truck is, and that's where we keep our extra hose and things. Anytime we go out and use, say, 5 sections of hose, we come back, we have a reel there that has clean hose on all the time. So we throw our 5 that we used in our cellar to be washed and put 5 clean ones on. And if it's before 6 o'clock at night, we wash it. If it's after 6 o'clock, the next turn washes it. Mm-hmm. So that way you're not up all night washing hose. So then beyond the apparatus floor is our bedroom, which we have beds. After 12 o'clock noon, if a man wants to lay down, he can lay down. And I just assume they lay down as be running around outside, because when that bell hits, they're here to go, and it's a matter of just the seconds that they're on the truck. And right next to the office here on this side of the apparatus floor, we have a lounge room where we sit and watch TV. And beyond that is our little kitchen where we do our own cooking. Now, a small house like this, we only have 4 men, and usually one is on vacation or a detail, and you usually wind up with only 3, so everybody does their own cooking. But these bigger homes, double houses, where they have 2 and 3 trucks, why, usually one man will cook for everybody. There'd be just too many around that stove at one time. They all want to eat at one time. So that way they take turns and they cook their meals that way.
And I see what appears to be a log in front of us. What type of information do you keep in the log?
Well, that log there, every time there's a box 5, we mark it down and mark the address. And the reason we do that, there might be right next to our district are out, and if we get another fire in that same district, we know we're going to go because them other companies are out. So we keep a log of everything, of companies going out, where they're going. And if we go out, we mark down their addresses, the time we went back on the radio, and the time we get back on the into the station and back in the service again. That's all logged. In case, then we carry another book that we mark down what we used, what we did, and anything that we can explain on it, and we write that down just in case some insurance company wants to stop and ask us a certain fire, while we look up the date and we can tell them who was there, what they used, how long they've been there, and the time of the day is marked, and when they left is marked. So all that information is of some use sometime along the line.
Mm-hmm. How much of a nuisance is a false alarm?
A false alarm is a big nuisance. In fact, I would say most of our men that got killed going to fires have got killed going to false alarms. And I've been trying to get a couple boxes out in our district here, because when that box goes off, you don't know if there's a fire or not. And you got to kind of rush there, just as if there was a fire, but you don't know there's not a fire until you get there. And they get to be a nuisance, and they usually seem to come in when it's always bad weather. Mm-hmm. Raining, slippery roads, or cold, and stuff like that, it gets to be a nuisance. When you get a box that hits anywhere from 20 to 25 times a year, if I had anything to say, I'd say pull it out. Because I would say this, as many years I've been in this house here, I don't think we've ever had one house fire that was turned in by a alarm box on a corner. Because most everybody has phones today. These are things that used to be in years and years ago when nobody had phones. But today, the kids are just using them for toys, and it's a bad thing. It's a bad thing.
Can you describe the type of training you received during your first years as a fireman?
Well, like I said before, when I first come in, I didn't get any training. And just like I said, at that time, them fellas, when they got new men on, it seemed like they were afraid to say anything, like they were going to take their job away. But the training that these fellows get today from fellows like me and others that take an interest in it, and In fact, the last few years now, they come out where the state says where they have to have 160 hours of training before they go into a station. So we have a school down in number one station, and this is all run through Ohio State University. And they go through their training, and we take them out and show them the different phases. And just like I tell them when we're working with them, we're not going to make firemen out of you, but, you know, a full-fledged fireman. But when you go out, you're going to have an idea what you're going to do, just like when we have to use Scott Air Packs, which we never had before, which is a wonderful thing today, because it's silly to go in and eat all that smoke when you can use a Scott Air. But I preach that, but I still run in without a Scott Air because I'm so used to it, and I want to get in there in a hurry, you see. And I don't want to take that time of putting one on. But these younger fellows, we preach to them to put a Scott Air on. And it works out good because I'll take the line and go in, and if I can knock the fire down, I'll lock it down, and then they'll come in with a Scott Air and open windows and doors and ventilate, which makes it wonderful, you see. So these fellows today, they're getting, I would say, a round picture of what they have to be expected to do when they come on the department here. Now this young fellow that's here, young Bill Pong, he just got on a year ago, and the chief asked me would I take him and work with him for a while. And I says, yeah. So that was supposed to be for 2 months, and I've had the kid for a year. Now I don't want to leave him because he's a good man, and he enjoys working out here. And we go out, I'll show them what to do. I still follow them right behind them, and I'll tell them what to do, what not to do. And that's the way they learn. You gotta not only tell them, but you gotta show them and lead them in there and let them do what they can do. And just like I told them, I don't care if you're on here 15 years, 20 years, some fellows can eat more smoke than others. And this is the truth. So just take what you can. And if you can't, let the man know that's in there with you that you're going out. And then that way, when he has to go out, he won't be looking for you. So that is the way that works. When you work in pairs, one man should tell the other if he's going out.
Mm-hmm. Could you describe a typical day on duty of Captain Fabrizio when you come into the station, your activities, the men's?
Well, when we first come in the station in the morning, well, we come in the morning. We're supposed to start from 8 o'clock in the morning till 8 the next morning, which is a 24-hour turn. I always try to get here about 15, 20 minutes late and see the man that I'm relieving, if there's any new orders out, because there's always new orders coming out. And if they had anything, a lot of times they'll have a fire and maybe something broke or something. Or something happened to the truck or something, we ask them all these kind of questions. And then if there is, as soon as the shop opens up, why, I'll get in touch with the shop. Or if there's any new orders out, as soon as we get here, we usually put a pot of coffee on, we'll have a cup of coffee, and we'll talk about these things. And after that, why, each man has his own quarters to clean. And it's only a matter of, oh, I'd say a half hour to 45 minutes actual work, and your quarters are clean. And once your quarters are clean, that is it. I mean, you don't have to be cleaning them two and three times a day. So your quarters are clean, and then you're actually on your own the rest of the time. Now, if you want to sit and read a book or something like that, that's all well and good. So a lot of fellas have little pet jobs showed a couple of these fellows how to make chairs out of cans, you know, and they're doing that to kill the time, especially in the winter months. Summer months, it's different. You always have something to do, outside work or something like that. But in the winter months, 24 hours is a long time. So we try to have little pet jobs doing to keep us busy and occupied. And that is really all you have to do when you're a fireman, is wait for the work to come in. And we've had people come and say, boy, it's pretty easy sitting down. You know, I said, well, all right, you go home, set your house afire, and I'll gladly go to work, see? And then it's a different story when it hits their place.
Right.
But they expect you to be on the go all the time. I tell them, this is one job where we have to wait for the work to come to us. We don't go looking for it. And that's the way them things go in the fire department. You just have to wait till they come. And when they come, why, then you got to get out there as quick as you can, and you don't know what you're going to run into because every fire is different. And sometimes they're dangerous, and sometimes they're not. So until you get there, you don't know what you have. So that's the way the day is spent in the fire station. So
I've heard firemen use the term fast and slow houses, and this east side is one of the older sections of town. Is
well,
you have a small house here. Is
what
this
they
considered
mean,
a fast
what
house?
They mean by slow and fast houses, this house right here where you're at now is rather a fast house. What we mean by fast house, it has a lot of calls. Now we don't only get fire calls since we're out here so far. Mm-hmm. We get heart attack cases where we'll go and give them oxygen with our resuscitator and call an ambulance and administer oxygen until the ambulance gets there. We have a lot of accidents that we have to go to and then maybe call an ambulance if it's needed, or a wrecker or police or whatever's needed. So it's a variety of things where you're moving all the time on different things. And some of these houses, we might move in 1 month what they might move maybe in 6 months, you see. So that is what they say when they refer to a slow house or a faster house. It's the number of runs that they get, a variety. For example, 1 month there, we had 54 runs in this house in 1 month's time. So that is a lot of runs, where some of these houses get 10 and 12, and they think they're busy, you see. So it's a variety out here. And it's not always fires, though, because our work is not only fire department work. That is our main concern, is life and property, see. And people are in trouble, they come here, they know they'll get some kind of help, you know. And so that's what we're here for.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember about the large fires you participated in? I'm sure over your 30 years you must have participated in some of the larger fires in the Youngstown area.
Well,
can you discuss a couple?
Yeah, there's, for example, we had one. I wasn't on here more than about a year, I think, and we had a big fire down on Federal Street. That is our main street downtown. I think they call it the Clear Silk at that time. And it was a fire. Just to give you an example, you don't know what you're running into. This happened to be a cellar fire, but you don't know until you get in, because the whole building is just charged with smoke. Mm-hmm. So after getting the front door open so that we could make an entrance, it was too smoky to walk in. And in them days, like I said, we didn't have Scott Airs, which was a good thing in one way, because we had to get down low and crawl on the floor. Well, we got about halfway back to the building and still didn't see any fire, and then all of a sudden you stick your hand out and there's no more floor. The back part had gone down already. So automatically we rushed out as fast as we could. After we get outside, and then we told the chief and the other fellows that are out there, go around through the back, through the cellar, because it's down the cellar. The floor is already out in the back end there. And now it's things like these that you don't know, and if you're not using common sense and be careful, not only not to hurt yourself, but not to hurt other fellows, it would be no problem at all just to rush in there and have two or three guys drop right in that cellar and you'd never see them again. That would be the end of it, you see. So them are fires that you will run into once in a while, is that kind of a fire where you don't know what you have till you can get to the base of a fire, ventilate it so you can get that smoke out and see exactly what you have. Now in this particular fire that I'm talking about, we thought we had it out, which we did. The second floor, there was no fire, third floor, no fire, and while we were just about ready to go, we see the roof breaking out on fire. And what happened, see, fire travels in three different ways, by radiation, by conduction, or convection. And this here worked by conduction, because these great big heavy electric cables from the cellar, they go all the way up through the roof and then out to your poles. Well, that is all copper and that carries heat. And it got so hot that it just got hot all the way up, and up near the roof where it was patched around there, it got hot enough that it started the roof afire. So you had no fire on the middle floors, but then you had a roof fire. Now you see, they say, how the hell did that fire get started there? Well, that's how it got started, because fire travels in three different ways, you see. So that is why when we go into a building, they'll say, what'd you make a hole here for? What'd you make a hole there for? Well, by feeling You can tell if there's fire in a wall by feeling, looking at it to see if it's blistered or the paint is discolored, or feeling with the back of your hand, or you can even hear a rumble in there. And if you hear that, you better get a line there and make a hole because it's going up through the wall. And a wall acts just like a chimney because it's straight up, and that flame is going to go straight up. First thing you know, you might have a cellar fire, and it gets between the walls. You're going to have one up in the attic if you don't get it in time. So you got to move and move fast, you see. So that is why, going back to the other, it's good to train these fellas when they see things like that. They know, you know what to expect out of it, instead of not letting them try to learn all that on their own, you see. So it makes for better firemen, and it makes for less fire loss, too.
What about the Youngstown Club or St. Columba fires? Were you involved in those?
I was on that St. Columbus fire, but
Do you remember anything?
I was rather new on the department at that time, and I really don't remember too much about it, only being stuck outside and three fellas on an end of a line pouring water into it. I mean, the damage was already done, and we were more or less there for wetting it down. You know, the bulk of the fire was knocked down. So there wasn't really that much on that fire that I wasn't the first company in, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm. What changes in the fire department did you notice over your years in service?
Changes?
Changes in the department itself.
Well, on the fire department changes, I have noticed from just the time that I've been on, some of your chiefs that you get are so much stricter than others. And sometimes when you're dealing with a group of men, you have to be strict. You have to. Because you give one guy a leeway, another guy sees it and he wants it, and the first thing you know, it mushrooms out, and then first thing you know, you have no control over them. So they have made a lot of different rules and things, and then we'd had different chiefs come in, and they thought that was wrong, and they would take it off, and then the men would take advantage of it, and then they'd have to throw it right back on again. Then he was no good because he did it. It's all things like this, that everything we lost because of the men themselves. And if they would just go try and go along with things and do what's right instead of taking advantage of seeing what they could actually get out of, you know. Because we have fellas today, they'll work harder trying to get out of a little work than rather than just go do it and forget it. That's true. They'll work harder trying to get out of it, and they just irritate you, you know what I mean? Because after all, let's face it, these fellas are all married men, most of them are. And they have families, and they know what their duties are. And they're not like kids where you have to tell them every day what to do. But we have fellas that you do have to remind them what they have to do, and I can't see that. And that is, years ago, it didn't seem to be that way. You know, everybody knew what they had to do, they did it. Maybe because they appreciated the job, because to me, this job is actually a snap from what way I used to work, you know. Mm-hmm. In fact, my first two pays when I came on here, I wouldn't even go and get. I had one of the fellas pick them up for me because I worked 90 hours a week in a packing house, like I said, in the Depression days. And when I come on here, for the amount of work I did, these fellas thought they did a lot of work, and I didn't think we did anything, you know what I mean? That's your difference between your men, see? And even till today, I wouldn't expect my men to do anything that I couldn't do or wouldn't do myself. And in fact, they're always hollering that I always want to be the first one in, you know. Well, I'm just so used to it. Just because I'm their captain, I don't want to say, go get it, go do this, because I don't know what's in there. Mm-hmm. And if something would happen to one of them, I would never forgive myself for it. But if I can't take it, I don't expect any of them to take it. And I'll tell them, let's get out, and that's it. So that's the way I always was, and that's the way I'll always be.
Is there any type of periodic organizational meetings, say all the captains get together, or the battalion chief, or either the chief?
Well, we have our regular local meetings are once a month, and that is just for union affairs and things that's going on and what they want to do and one thing or another. But we have started on our particular turn here, a captain's meeting once a month. We meet down at number one station, and anything that anybody wanted to bring up, they would bring it up and they'd thrash it out. And if they thought it was worthwhile, we would try it. Mm-hmm. And just for example, this truck we have here, I'll show you after a thing that I had made to put on the back end of the truck. To me, it's just like an extra man. Because when our booster line is on the back, and we have to pull it out through the back. And if one man, like I say, most of the time we're with only three fellows here. And if one man would take it, he could go off to the side maybe 6, 8, 10 feet and would bind. So I had this little thing made, I'll show it to you after. And it's got rollers on four sides, and they drop it down in there, and you can go straight out on a 45, one man, and pull the whole thing right off. So we had that on for a few years. Then we had a chief in there that made me take it off. So I took it off. So when he got out, this other chief we have now come in, we're working three-handed all the time. Well, three men is really not enough on a truck. You should have at the minimum four. So we're working three men. To me, that's shorthanded. So I asked him to let me put this thing back on, and he did. And boy, I'll tell you, it's a wonderful thing. So that all helps in making the job easier on something like that. And
how much risk do you believe is involved in firefighting compared with other occupations?
Well, according to the books, there's more killed on the line of duty in firefighting than there is in police work. Over, that is counting the whole states now, not just one city.
Right.
All over the states, you'll find that you'll have more firemen killed in a year's time than you will policemen. Now, policemen you think is a real dangerous work, but the fire department is danger, a different kind of danger. You're not shot at, but you're getting into places where buildings crumble on you, you get trapped into places and you can't get out, that kind of danger, you see. Like I said before, when you go into a building, you have no idea how far that building has been burnt or how far it has been burning or how long it's been burning until you get there. And you think there's a floor there a lot of times, but there's none, and down you go. We've had a lot of fellas fall from one floor to the other and break their legs and things like that, you know. So it, and a lot of them, if they fall into a place where they're knocked unconscious or something, they suffocate with the smoke and that. So it's dangerous.
Have the salaries and benefits of firemen increased satisfactorily over the years with other occupations?
Well, let's put it this way. They have increased some, but not like your steel mills and things of that nature. But they did come a long, long ways, a long ways. In fact, even the fellas today, when they're starting off, they're making a lot more money than we did, you know. And the benefits are much greater today. So today it is a job that I would say, well, give you an example. When I took the test, I think there was only about 40 or 50 people that took it. And this year, just last week, they gave a test, and there was over 300 that took it. So you see, they're looking for that security, plus the salary that we are now getting and the benefits that we are getting. And even the fellows that are retirees, their pension are much greater today than they were, you know. So all in all, I would say it's a good place to work today, especially today.
Mm-hmm. How long has there been a Fireman's Union in Youngstown here?
Oh, Fireman Union before I came on. They've had one for years and years.
Mm-hmm.
But years and years ago, there was they had a union, but they never seemed to do anything with it. Because if they had a complaint, they'd go to the city officials and they'd tell them their story, and they say, well, that's the best we can do, take it or leave it, and they just left it, you see. Where today, these younger fellas, they have a little more courage and they fight more and they seem to be getting more. So it has changed quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Can you take us through a dry run of, let's set up a hypothetical fire. Say there's a house burning in your district up by East High School somewhere, and you're the first unit in, and it's Kaplan. What would you do? Take us through the motions of what you would do.
All right. If we had a fire in this district, and it was our district, and we were first in, being that we are working shorthanded, when you approach the fire, you can just about size it up as to what you're going to need. If you can see just a little bit of smoke and not much fire, usually you'll take care of it with our own booster line. If it's a kitchen fire, even though there's flames coming out of the kitchen windows, if it's gone that far, I still would hit it with my booster line because I know I can put it out with that, because this truck here has 400 gallons of water, more than these other trucks, because there's a lot of districts we have out here have no hydrants. So when we got this truck, we have a bigger tank on. Okay, now, if it was beyond one room, I would have one of my men drop at a hydrant and catch what we call a feeder line, a 2.5 feeder line, and run it into our truck. And I would call on the radio and tell them, the next company in, take my 1.5 inches, because I have on this truck here 2.5 inches pre-connected. Mm-hmm. So the reason I did that, I told the chief if he would allow me, and he says yes, because out here, next company in is quite a while getting here. And when they have to take hose off their truck and then bring it over and hook it on ours, there's too much time lost. So I got 2.5 inches pre-connected, I'll show you after. So when they come, all they have to do is grab one of my 1.5 inches and they're right with me in a short order. Now, if it was a building, a big store or something, and that was really gone, then I would have to lay 2.5 inch lines to the fire and then go back and have my truck pump from the hydrant. And then get on the radio and tell them, next company's in, hook up to me because I'm hooked up at a hydrant. Well, then they know we really have a big fire going. Mm-hmm. But they usually wait for what I have to say over the air to them, as then they can what they expect when they get there, you see.
As the first company in, and as captain, are you in charge until
I'm in charge until the battalion chief gets there. When he gets there, I'll give him a quick resume of what we've done and what I seen and what we got, and then he'll check it out, and then he takes over from there.
And is there any type of follow-up, say, after the fire is extinguished? Do you have any responsibilities then?
Since we were first in, after the fire is out and he thinks it's safe for everybody to go back, me being first in, he'll say, Frank, before you leave, check it out again. And I'll make my rounds, because a lot of times you think you have it out and you got a smoldering spot. And if you don't get that smoldering spot, by the time you get back to the station, you got another fire going. So we have to check it out real good to see and tell. I try to show these fellows the difference between a place that's smoldering and one that's just steam coming out. Because a lot of that stuff gets so hot that when you put water on it, it steams for quite a while. And I tried to show them the difference between steam and smoke, where there is a little fire someplace. And if you leave that little fire go, in another half hour, you're going to have another big one. So I try to show them that. And before we leave, we make sure that there's no places that are smoldering. And that is checking the thing out. And then when we come back, then I feel safe that we don't have to go back there. Mm-hmm. But if it did break out, we would be the ones who would have to go back, because we were first in, you see.
Taking three different types of fires, let's say we have a house fire, so you have a good-sized residence, you have maybe a school fire, and then maybe you'd have even a larger thing, maybe a hospital. Is there? Does your approach vary radically?
Oh, yes. Three times? Yeah, you do. Because if it's a house fire, 9 out of 10 times it's going to be either a bedroom or a kitchen. Mm-hmm. That's the bulk of your house fires, is in a kitchen or a bedroom, smoking in bed. So we know when we get a house fire, especially if it hasn't been gone for a long time where the flames aren't coming out of every window, you know what I mean? Usually a house fire, if people are home or the neighbors see it or something of that nature, where we can get to it in a hurry, why, we can pretty well keep it to that one room. All right, then if we had a school depends, or a school or a business place or a meeting place, it all depends on the time of the day as to the work that you're going to do, because if it's in daytime, you know there's kids there. So the first thing you do, you don't bother with the fire, you get them kids out and make sure that they get out. And the second company in, then we'll still lay a line, and if we can see the fire, we'll have one man hit that fire, but the rest will all go for these kids. You gotta get them kids out, because like I said before, life is first and the property is second. And then as the other companies come in, if you need a hand on getting some more kids out, they'll help. If not, they'll go to work right on that fire immediately. But if it's in the evening or late hours, you know there's no kids in there, so then you don't have to worry about getting anybody out. Then you concentrate on the fire. Like we had this here school right across the street here, John White School, not too long ago. And it was in the evening. So we go right around the back, and I knew where the boiler room was, and I busted one door in, got into that boiler room, and got it out right away. And we found out later that it was a set fire, but we don't know that. We don't know there's gasoline in there until we get in there. But luckily, we knocked it down in a hurry. By the time the other companies come, all they had to do was ventilate. But we didn't have to worry about kids. And the same thing when you have a place of meeting. Now, meeting halls usually in the daytime are vacated, and usually they have them at night. Well, at night, if you get a hall like that, you know there's somebody there. So you try to see who's in, or if there is any, and how many, and you know, on them lines. And then you have to figure a way to get them out of there. The same way when we have these apartment houses, like up in Eastway Drive there, there's 10 and 12 families in each one of them. Well, if you get a fire in one building or one section downstairs, in no time, that whole half, up and down, is going to be covered with smoke. And then in the wee hours of the morning, you got to start banging on doors and that to get these people up, to get them out of there, or they're going to suffocate. They don't die from burning, they suffocate and die first, and then they'll burn up. So you got to get them out of there before that happens, you see. So every fire, like I said, is different. It all depends on what you have, the time of the day, and even the weather has a lot to do with it. If it's real cold, you know, you can't be charging all your lines and leaving them set without using them, because they'll freeze up on you. And the same way with your pump, you got to keep your pump going and your motors going, or else they'll freeze up, because these trucks don't carry alcohol or antifreeze in them. And because of the speed that they have to pump, because this truck here will pump 1,000 gallons a minute. And if they had alcohol in there, they'd be boiling over, you see. So it's your seasons has a lot to do. Your roads have a lot to do. And the kind of a building that you're going to, that's why every summer we'll ride and see if there's a new project being opened up, where there's hydrants, and the layout of it. And if we get a call there, then we know where the boiler room is, if it's a boiler room. And if it's a single apartment, then it's either the kitchen or a bedroom. That's the only place it could be, you see. So that's what you have to consider when you're going to these fires. While you're going there, you're trying to figure out what you have, and then when you just about get there, you can look and see about what you have. And then you can determine if you're going to lay a big line or hit it with a booster or inch and a half, or if you need help from other companies. There's many, many times we go out here and we see we can handle it ourselves. We'll catch them on the radio and stop them and send them back. Why let them come all the way out there? Because a lot of times from the time we stop until they get there, they might have another mile, 2 miles to go. They could get in an accident. So we stop them if we can. And the chief has to come all the way from town, and he appreciates that. Because there's a lot of times he gets to Albert Street, and he'll hear me say, send them back, we can handle it, you know. But when I don't send them back, he knows they got something, see. But that's the way I work it out here. And if I can handle it alone, why, I try to keep the other companies in the barn where they belong, you know.
How big of a problem are spectators to contend with? I was reading in the Vindicator article this recent West Lakes Crossing disaster.
Yeah.
And they said there are hundreds of spectators, and if that thing could have blown, it really would have been
disaster. People are curious, you know. I'll tell you, even in, we've had fires 4, 5 in the morning, and where these cars come from, I don't know. But they'll follow a truck down the street. You'll get maybe 3, 4, 5 at that hour of the morning. And then when these other trucks are coming in, they can't get through.
No.
And they're just curious to see what's going on. And especially in the daytime, I guess that they're in your way, but there's times when they are in your way. And I'll tell you, there's times when we go out here, like I say, it seems like such a long time before someone else come. I have asked some of the fellows that was around, give me a hand on pulling this hose, and they'll do that. Because, like, you know, when you only have 3 men, you have 1 man on the truck, engineer, he's got to take care of that pump and that. The other man's at the hydrant. I'm here by myself. I got to pull that 1.5 off or 2.5 off there and drag it up to the house, and that's pretty heavy. So you take each section, the time you get a charge and everything, you got about 138 pounds there, and you start pulling 5 or 6 sections, you're pulling a lot of weight. So if you can see a little hand that'll give you a hand, why, you appreciate it.
If crowds get too big,
well,
is the police department calling them?
Oh, yeah, they're supposed to come in every fire.
Oh.
Every fire, they're notified, and they should come, because there's times when a hose has to go across a road, and they'll maybe... If it's a bad fire and they have 2 or 3 trucks together, they'll detour the traffic. They're supposed to take care of the traffic. So every house fire, or what we call a box 5, they should be notified and be there. And I've noticed that they hold true to that pretty good. Very good.
Is Station 12 or any other regular station other than the main station involved in other activities besides firefighting, say inspecting buildings within your district?
Yeah.
Does that come under your jurisdiction?
Yeah. Every summer we'll go to these different projects that we hear is going up, and we'll see how they're laid out. So if we get a call there, we know how to go in. But if you don't go, you have no idea where anything is. So that is why we like to go to these different buildings and your different stores and see how their back entrance, if there's an entrance way or not. These are things that you should find out before a fire, and it saves you a lot of time and you do a better job in putting it out rather than just sit here and do nothing. And in fact, we, the last few years, we've been going out checking hydrants where the water department used to do that. And we have a log that every hydrant is inspected and checked, and if there's any defect or fault, we mark it down, and we try to follow through to make sure that they correct it. Because we have hydrants way out here that our hydrant wrench will not turn, because they're an octagon-shaped top on them. And these people out there have no water. So they go to the hydrants and they use pipe wrenches and things like that to get water, and they got them things chewed off so they're just round.
Mm-hmm.
We had one fire out there. We had the adjustable hydrant wrench, but we couldn't get it tight enough. It would just turn on there, so we had to run back to the truck and get our pipe wrench to open it, because the threads on that thing was just all chewed off. And that is why we're making these inspections now, and a lot of them caps haven't been off for a while, and they're froze on there. Even hitting them with a hammer, you couldn't break them loose. So we report that, and then the water department is supposed to check them out. And when we're out looking at buildings and things like that, why, you kind of get the lay of the land, so if something come, you know just where you're going to go and what you're going to do. That's just like now, if they would call me right now and says, North High School, the kitchen. Well, I wouldn't even go through the front. I'd go through the back way, because I know where the kitchen is. The same way with the boiler room, because if I went in the front, I'd have to drag maybe 200, 250 feet of hose to get to the back where I could pull the truck right up there, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So by making these inspections and finding out the lay of the land, when something does happen, it makes the job easier and you do a better job with it.
In And isn't there a state law that business establishments have to have their fire extinguishers that they have checked, or is there a state inspector that...
Yeah, they have fire extinguishers, and they have companies that check them out every year. We don't do fire extinguishers. There's companies that do that. And there's certain kinds have to be checked every year, and for the pressure in them, and CO2s, they have a lot of them that are pressurized water, and foam, the soda and acid they're not using anymore because they're so dirty. And carbon tech they're not using anymore because when you take and throw that on a hot, anything that's real hot, it makes a deadly gas, so that they're not using anymore. So the fire extinguishers are all taken care of by different fire extinguishing companies. But if they bring them in to us, we see that they're charged or filled up for them. And we have a fellow in mind that we will send them to him, and that he takes care of them for them.
How about if there's a... If there were to be, or in fact in the 60s when we had civil disorders, if there was a national or state emergency, would the firemen be called upon to take part?
Yes. When that was, when that happened here, we had the National Guards stayed right here in the station with us.
Oh.
And every time we moved, one of them rode with us. And there was two fellows here. And they would take turns riding the truck with us, and they went right with us all the time. Yeah, every truck in town had National Guards on them. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But we didn't have any trouble out here, though. It did seem to be in that one section, you know. Okay. But all the stations were alerted and protected in case, though.
Mm-hmm. Where are some fires prevalent during the 40s and 50s?
Not too much, no. In fact, they had some. Well, let's say they always had some, but they didn't have them like they're having today. It just seems like, the bad thing about that is this. No matter how much equipment you can find in the building when you know it's arson, you can find bottles of gas or empty bottles in every room of that house, and every room is on fire, you know it's a set job, still the insurance company has to pay until they can prove somebody set that, you see? And that is the bad thing. Now, if they would start, and I think you'll find that where they will, in case of arson, there's gonna be a delay in payment, or maybe not the full coverage in payment, and that's going to stop a lot of this. Because we have always noticed from years gone by, the only arson cases that we really had, not so many homes, because people didn't want to bring their homes up, but it was business places. When business was bad, around the first of the year, we got a lot of them. But anymore, we're getting buildings, we're getting homes, we're getting everything now. And they know that they're carrying insurance. And I'll, just like an insurance man says to me, he says, Frank, he says, you have insurance on your home? I says, yeah. He says, all right, what if some night someone bombs and burns your place out? Would you want paid? I says, why, sure. He says, yeah, but we find bottles with gas all over the place. You see, he says, the people that are paying that insurance, they're entitled to that money till we can prove. And that is one of the hardest things to prove is arson. You almost have to catch a guy coming out of the door. And then he could lie and says, I thought I saw fire and it's too much for me, and how'd I go? And still you can't prove that it was him, even though he was coming out of the door. Because it's his word against your word, you see?
Mm-hmm.
It's a hard thing to prove. One of the hardest things to prove there is arson. And I think that is why there's so much of it going on. And if they do catch them, if they throw the book at them, maybe it would stop some of them. They'd think twice. Just like we've had two or three burn up. This here kid that set this fire died. He got burned up and died. The one up on Belmont there, on that mm-hmm. that restaurant up there, he burned up and died from burns that he got. So if they get caught, and the ones that don't burn and die, and they do catch them, and they throw the book at them, maybe it would stop a lot of this. But until they do that, why, I guess it's going to be. That's all. And we can't do nothing about it. just go and put them out, that's all. Be careful.
Be careful.
Oh, yeah. Because anymore, they're putting this here gasoline in bags. And just about the time you think you got it out, that thing's got just enough heat ready to bust, and down it comes, and boy, you're right in the middle. Just like we had one boy got caught in that one up there. That thing busted and burst out on him, and he's lucky he's living today, that kid. Yes, sir. We had that happen just about 2 months ago up there on Belmont Avenue, that restaurant up there. Yeah, he really got burnt and burnt bad.
What injuries have you incurred over your 31 years of service?
I've been very, very fortunate. I have never had an injury. And now, when I'm not only talking about the fire department, but I'm even going back from the time I got out of school in 31. Mm-hmm. I worked all the time I've worked in the Truscon, in the packing house, and in here since 31. I don't like to brag, but I have to. I haven't lost one day's work since I got out of high school. So I've just been a fortunate kid. Yeah, I've been very, very fortunate. Healthy, wise, and injury-wise. I've been very, very fortunate.
Mm-hmm. You hinted an answer to this question earlier. Do you feel that the four-man staff is adequate per house?
When I come on, we used to have a five-man crew. And we had a five-man crew, and with a man on vacation or a man off sick, you still had four men. And if anything less than four, they'd transfer a man from another house and bring him over to make a four-man crew. Mm-hmm. But they built a couple of new houses, and well, they claim that they don't have the money to keep a full crew like that anymore, so we've been working what they call a four-man crew. But with the vacations and things that they have, we have three sets of vacations. When one finishes, another one starts. When that's finished, another one starts. Rather than give us money, they've been giving us time off. And by doing that, we never have more than three men. I'll bet you in a year's time, there isn't maybe 10 days that I have a full crew. And other than that, it's always three. And when I do have four, they're pulling one out to fill some place that only has two. So they're making a third man with him. So it is wrong, it is definitely wrong, but there's nothing you can do about it. The only way you could get away with that, you would have to close two or three houses and still hire more men, even although you close more men. Because when you close one house, you're only picking up 12 men. There's four to a turn, mm-hmm. So you're only picking up four men. And so it's a bad situation. Now, your fire underwriters come in, they check this, that, and the other, and they say it's required for five men, but that they don't want to hear. But other things that they want to hear, they say, oh, we got to go this, the fire underwriters say it, you see. Well, if you're going to go with what they say in one thing, let's go all the way, see. Don't just pick out what you want to do, you know. And so that's the way them things go. But it should, any house shouldn't have less than five men into a house. With one man off, you still have four. And you almost need four, because you have a man at the hydrant. Until he gets hooked up, water turned on, he is not at the truck, and that's when you really need him, when you first get there. The engineer, he's getting his pump in service, he's getting this ready and that ready, and who does it leave? Just the captain. He's got to pull the hose out, put the nozzle on, drag it to the building, and then holler, give me water, you know? And by that time, you're so damn tired that you don't care if you get water or not. So that's what I say, you almost have to have, it should have at least 4 men at all times, should have, to be efficient, you know?
Mm-hmm. Before the interview, you mentioned to me that you were working with some of the volunteer mm-hmm. departments. Is there much cooperation between the Youngstown Fire Department and other local volunteer?
Well, let's put it this way. Most, I don't care where you go, most paid departments think that your volunteers are not firemen. You follow me? Mm-hmm. But let me tell you this. Your volunteer outfits today have better equipment and more equipment than us paid guys do. And I can prove that, you know what I mean? I've told that even to my chief. I said, I'll take you out in Christville, I'll show you. You want to see some equipment, I'll show you some equipment. And anything you want is on that truck. And I've been trying to get foam here, for example, and because we have this airport down here. We've had a couple fires down there where planes crash and guys burned up, see? So the only thing I can go to is my high pressure water and use that. Where if I had foam, I could use that. But I just can't get it. And it really isn't that expensive. I think about $300, $350 would set me up with foam, you know. So it isn't that the cost is so great, but they just don't want to give it to you. This house here, I would say in the last 5 or 6 years is when we finally got two Scott Airs. We used to work with nothing. We used to have them little canteen types like they used in the mines, and that all them things were good for was to bring a refrigerator that sprung a gas leak out and drag it out on the porch. I mean, you couldn't go into a fire with them because they're not built for that, you see. And that's what we had out here. It just seems like the surrounding station at that time had less equipment than anything, and it isn't right. But we have two Scott Airs now, and we try to use them.
Do you have any closing comments or observations or some suggestions you could make over your years of experience?
Well, I'll tell you, I have made, since, like I told you before, when Coitsville started, I started over there. And I always was interested in firefighting and tried to do the job as quick and as easy as possible. And I have even gone as far as I made a complete set of things to go out and demonstrate to people. For example, I had a little box built just like a house, and I had fuses in there. And I would explain to the people about overloading their fuses box. And then I would shut one switch off and hook it up directly to a wire and tell them that if they had a fuse too strong, a lot of the fuses will find with a penny behind them so that they don't have to be replacing them all the time. And then eventually this wire would catch fire and it would be out in the open where they could see it, the way I had this thing made, see? Mm-hmm. And I would explain it to them. Them wires is usually in a wall, you don't see them. But that's what happens when you overload them. And then I had another thing made where I would take gasoline, and I had a transformer, and I had a handle made where I would take it and show the people the arc that it would make. And I would stick it down, I'd carry a little jar and put gas in it and stick this right down in the gasoline and arc it, and it wouldn't do anything. I says, but when I operate this alone, because I don't want to be pulling that out and the guy hit the button by mistake. Because as soon as I get to the top, I says, if you see this white fumes that form on top, we would have an explosion here, just like about 5 sticks of dynamite. So that is why I do this by myself, see. And explain it to him how I had a Pyrex tube 4 foot long. And I would take cotton and wet it with gasoline on one end, and I'd put a candle down this end and show them how the fumes would go down and catch this on fire. That's what happens with a lot of these one-story homes where the garages are attached to the house. Mm-hmm. They have their car, they have their lawnmowers, and they have gasoline in there. And they're supposed to keep them in tin containers, and some of them have them in glass, and maybe somebody bumps the glass and it breaks, and they think the gasoline evaporated and it's all gone. Where the fumes are heavier than air, and especially in the summertime, it would get in that cellar door, go down the steps, and when it got over to the pilot light of their hot water tank, they had an explosion. And then they're calling the gas company up and says, your gas leak and got an explosion. Well, when they find out and check it out, it was gasoline from their own garage that did it, you see. So it's little things like that in this demonstration I would bring out and show them. And I used to go quite a bit doing that. But it got to the point where there was just no free time. Everybody wanted you to go, you know. And I didn't mind doing it if there was a big crowd there where you had somebody you could explain things. But one time I went out and there was only about, oh, he told me to be 50 or 60 when I got there. They miscued on the date or something, and there was only five or six, and I just got so disgusted, I said, that's it. If I have to come out for five or six people, why, I'm not coming no more, you know. Mm-hmm. Because you take all that stuff, you got to haul it out there and set it up and everything. But I enjoyed doing it. You know, that's like when I was working with these different departments. I start, like I said, with Coitsville, and these fellas from town used to say, you're silly for working with them. You're not getting nothing for it, you know. I says, listen, if I can help them guys from getting hurt, or if they could save a life, I would feel all my time is well spent. I had guys come to me that got in predicaments where they didn't know where they're at because of the smoke and the thing. They got all screwed up, you know, and they stopped and they thought what I told them how to get out in case that happened, and they got their bearings, and out they come, and they come and they thank me for some of the things that I explained for them, you see. And the way they pay me back is this. When they have a steak dinner or something, they always have it a day that I'm off. So you can't hate a bunch of guys like that, can you? So anything they have over there, they always try to have it the day that I'm off. And that's how they show their appreciation for what I did for them. And I enjoy doing it for them. Yeah.
Well, that was my last fire-related question. I just want to see... maybe for some local Youngstown history. You said you grew up in Youngstown. What was Youngstown like during the 30s, the Depression period? What were some of the recollections you have?
Well, the town wasn't anything like it is now. I mean, they had the streetcars in them days, and Federal Street was a real busy street all the way down to Basin Street. That's the way down on the far end of East Youngstown, or down at the east part of Youngstown here. Mm-hmm. And they were all busy stores. And as the, and I don't know, it just seemed like most of the people in them days, they lived in a neighborhood, they grew up there, their kids grew up there, and they got along so well, you know. I'll give you a good example. What I mean is this, like even when I was a kid, cars would come and they'd say, where's a certain street? I don't know, but who are you looking for? It could be somebody that lived way out in the Sharon Line. We'd tell them exactly how to get there and what house, because we knew everybody, you see. Mm-hmm. But today, the way people are moving in and moving out, some of the people don't even know who their next door neighbor is. Mm-hmm. And that's bad, because you always need a hand, or they need a hand, you know. And if you don't get along with your neighbors or get to know them, why, that is a bad, bad thing. And that's what I noticed. The big thing is everybody seemed to be more friendly before, help each other more. And then times have changed too, because a lot of these kids have grown up and got married and they moved away. And the older ones sold or died off, you follow me? And then the new ones coming in, why, they're total strangers and they don't care who lives across the street or this and that. And that's the way I think you'll find that over the whole town is that way. And it's just like a different generation, complete different thinking than it was before. And hell, it was nothing how we used to visit, for example, when we were kids, our relations and friends and that. But today, everybody is too busy with their own families, you see? And they're trying to do and do and outdo the other guy or something. I don't know what they're trying to do, but it seems that way. So. But Youngstown has grown in one way and has diminished in another way, because most of your people now, Youngstown is only so big and you can't move out, you're outside of the city limits, and that's just what they're doing, they're moving outside the city limits. Now your policemen and firemen are still compelled to live in the city, and they're fighting it, trying to get it so that they can move outside the city limits, but I don't know if they're... The people voted on it that they could, but still they won't let us. So until they say we can, why, we just can't, that's all. So that's what these new fellows are going to have to stay here and stay in the city limits. Because we're paid by the people in one way, and your school teachers are paid by the people in the same way, but still some of them don't even live in the state.
Right.
Because a lot of these have got Pennsylvania license on them, you see. So it just don't make sense where one group has to live here and another group don't have to live here. So I don't know what the outcomes are going to be. So